The UN Refugee Agency says the onslaught in Gaza has killed more children than 4 years of wars around the world. President Putin says Ukraine's recent military operations intend to meddle in Russia's upcoming presidential vote. And Iran, China, and Russia carry on with their joint naval drills in the Indian Ocean.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Israel presses ahead with indiscriminate targeting of Palestinians who are fasting in the holy month of Ramadan, as the last hopes for an immediate ceasefire vanishes into thin air. UNRWA says Israeli warplanes have hit one of its aid warehouses in Rafah. Five people were killed and scores more wounded, as Palestinians were waiting for humanitarian aid. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, Israeli airstrikes have claimed 88 Palestinian lives over the past day. The UN says the number of children killed during the first 4 months of the war on Gaza has topped all those killed in 4 years of wars across the globe. In northern Gaza alone, 27 children have starved to death. The health ministry has called on the UN and other child protection agencies for the provision of milk for the infants. The Palestinian death toll now stands at around 31,300, most of them women and children. The Gaza government says sending an aid ship from Cyprus to the besieged territory is not sufficient for millions of starving people. The spokesman for the government's press office says the ship's cargo does not exceed that of one or two trucks, and it will take days to arrive. He also stressed that there are some logistical uncertainties about the operation and raised concerns regarding Israeli inspections. Salama Maruf noted that a maritime aid corridor is far less efficient than overland routes. He called for international pressure on Israel to lay aid trucks through its border crossings. A ship carrying 200 tons of aid left Cyprus on Tuesday as part of a pilot project to deliver supplies to a population that is on the verge of famine. Several more Palestinians have lost their lives in the latest raids the Israeli forces launched on Tuesday evening on several parts of the occupied West Bank. Mona Kandil, a correspondent to Ramallah, joined us earlier with details. Let's take a listen.
Unfortunately, as you were saying, it seems that in less than 24 hours, the Israeli forces shot and killed six Palestinians all over the occupied West Bank. The latest Palestinian is yet another Palestinian minor, this time 14-year-old Mohammed Abu Hamid from the village of Al-Khadr, South Bethlehem. The Israeli military claimed that Mohammed Abu Hamid arrived on an electric bicycle at the tunnel's checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Quds and near Bethlehem. They claimed that he had a knife and that he succeeded to stab two Israeli soldiers. They were wounded and they are in light to moderate conditions. The Israeli forces then opened fire immediately at this 14-year-old Palestinian. They shot him and killed him and confiscated his body. Earlier, the Israeli forces stormed Jenin refugee camp and the city of Jenin, and exchange of fire have taken place between the Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. Two Palestinians were shot and killed. At least one of them was shot and killed by the Israeli forces while he was inside the complex of the Jenin government hospital, where clashes have been taking place outside the hospital, and the Israeli forces opened fire at the people there at the conflicts of the hospital, and one Palestinian was killed there. Earlier, two Palestinians were shot and killed at the village of Ajib, northwest Al-Quds. The Israelis claimed that a day earlier, Palestinians threw explosive devices or cocktail or Molotov cocktails at the Israeli military checkpoint there. Earlier, there's another Palestinian, this time in Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds, after the, Al-Maghrib and iftar of the first day, the second day of Ramadan. He was at the outside his home playing with a number of his relatives. The Israeli forces opened a fire and shot him in the chest. Then they claimed that he was playing with fireworks with the other children, and that's why the Israeli forces opened fire at him, shot him and killed him. The number of the Palestinians who were shot and killed by the Israeli soldiers since the 7th of October is today over 430 Palestinians.
An Israeli drone strike on a car near the southern Lebanese city of Tyre has killed a member of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The drone hit the vehicle near the Palestinian refugee camp of Rashidiyah. The assassinated Hamas member has been identified as Hadi Mustafa. According to security sources, a civilian who was passing by on his motorcycle was also killed in the strike. Reports say the Israeli drone was hovered above the site for several minutes before targeting the car. Soon after the strike, sirens were also heard in the occupied territories, indicating possible retaliatory attacks by Lebanon's Hezbollah movements on Israeli targets. Tensions remain high between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Both sides have been exchanging fire, but Israel has intensified attacks on civilians in Lebanon in recent weeks. Earlier we spoke to our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, for more information on the latest tensions between Israel and Lebanon.
We do not have confirmation or the names of those who were killed in that vehicle, but it is pretty close to one of the Palestinian refugee camps in South Lebanon. It is possible that there is a Palestinian figure that was in the vehicle. It could also be a member of the resistance. We know now that after the strike against this car, sirens were sounding in several areas in the Western Galilee parts. And so that is probably we have those sirens because Hezbollah seems to have launched several rockets. We also know that rockets were fired toward the Golan Heights. That is something that Hezbollah has also maintained is part of its scope of operations as well. But we also know that there's a lot of threats from the Israelis, a lot of talk that they want to go on with a blow against Lebanon, a full-scale war. You have elites within the Israeli regime. It's not the time now for any sort of war against Hezbollah, against Lebanon, while the war in Gaza remains. And he said very clearly this, these elite figures and other political figures also in the Israeli regime are stressing that we all know that Hezbollah is not going to stop until the war in Gaza stops.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, thousands of Jordanians rallied in Amman and across the country protest against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza.
Today, on the first day of Ramadan, we are standing before the genocide, the enforced hunger and killing, the targeting of children, women, and unarmed civilians, and the demolition of houses over inhabitants. Of course, our message is to create a humanitarian land corridor to northern Gaza, where the Palestinian citizens suffer from hunger and dehydration inflicted by the Zionist enemy that is leading this offensive war, this genocide and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people.
Carrying Palestinian flags and banners, the protesters chanted pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel slogans. They also demanded unhindered delivery of aid to Gaza as they gathered near the Israeli embassy. Jordan, that is hosting 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed several rallies in solidarity with Gazans since Israel launched its war on the besieged Strip. Similar rallies have taken place in other countries as well. President Vladimir Putin says the main objective of Ukraine's recent attacks on his country is to interfere with the upcoming presidential election in Russia.
I have no doubt about it. The main goal is to, if not disrupt the presidential election in Russia, then at least somehow interfere with the normal process of expressing the will of citizens. Secondly, as I've already said, it's about informational component. And thirdly, if they have some success, to get some kind of chance, some kind of argument, some kind of trump card in a possible future negotiation process.
In an interview, Putin said that attacks by Ukrainian forces are aimed at diverting attention from their failures on the front line. He added that Russian forces have completely taken over the initiative in the war. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson also said the U.S. seeks to discourage Russian citizens from taking part in the election, which is due to be held between March 15 and 17. Maria Zakharova says the U.S. also plans to carry out cyber attacks on Russia's remote electronic voting system. Tensions between Russia and the U.S. escalated to unprecedented levels following the war in Ukraine. Putin has once again warned that he is ready to deploy nuclear weapons if his country's sovereignty is threatened. Iran, China, and Russia are continuing their joint naval drills in the northern Indian Ocean. The spokesman for the drills says vessels from the three countries carried out shooting practice at naval targets. Rear Admiral Mustafa Tajadini said the exercise, dubbed Marine Security Belt 2024, was led by Iran's homemade destroyer Dena. the vessels went into an attack formation and participated in a photo exercise. The drills were supervised by Iranian helicopters. The maneuvers, which will end on Friday, are aimed at reinforcing regional security, fighting piracy, and expanding cooperation among participating countries. Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry tenders his resignation as violence plagues his country. Henry says his government will step aside after the establishment of a transitional council, stressing that Haiti needs peace and stability. When the violence erupted last week by the alliance of gangs, Henry was in Kenya to sign an agreement to send 1,000 Kenyan police officers to the Caribbean nation to restore order. He was unable to return to Haiti as the security situation deteriorated around the airport in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, the U.S. says a new team of Marines has been sent to Haiti to help protect the American embassy there. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, also promised $100 million for UN-backed force to stabilize the country and $30 million in humanitarian assistance. Haiti has been plagued by spiraling violence in recent weeks as armed gangs have taken control, calling on Henry to go. The U.S. House of Representatives has overwhelmingly approved a bill that forces the popular social media app TikTok to either sever ties with China or become unavailable in the U.S. American lawmakers voted 352 in favor of the proposed law in a rare moment of bipartisan unity. Meanwhile, Beijing has accused the U.S. of suppressing TikTok, calling the motion a bullying act to damage the international investment environment. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson has warned Washington of the repercussions of the move. Wang Wenbin says that the decision will inevitably come back to bite the U.S. itself. Washington has long expressed concerns over the Chinese-owned app, claiming that it puts national security at potential risks. TikTok owners, however, have repeatedly rejected the claims. If the U.S. bill becomes law, the app's parent company will be forced to sell TikTok within 6 months or face a ban from American app stores. Let's bring in Camila Escalante to shed more light on this from Bogota. Well, Camila, welcome to the program. What news do you have for us on this?
Well, the latest overnight was that Southcom, the United States Southern Command, which the United States says is the area of the military, the section of the military responsible for the Caribbean and Latin America, has deployed an elite unit of U.S. Marines to the Haitian capital. It said that in an overnight statement just days ago. It also put out a statement saying that it was augmenting security around its embassy in the Haitian capital, saying that for that reason, diplomats and personnel would be airlifted by helicopter in and out of the area. So it seems that obviously they're preparing for somewhat of a more intensified security situation right now. I'm not sure if you mentioned this already, but the president was unable to return to the country, having traveled abroad. And he was reportedly for some time, last we know of him, in Puerto Rico being reported or being protected by the FBI. We're hearing a lot of reactions from around the continent this week, including by President Nicolas Maduro. He said that Haiti has been martyred and dismembered by U.S. interventionism. And from within, he said the destructive force of anti-values and drug trafficking took over Haiti. And he says that this is all, of course, repeating what people in Haiti are saying. This is the work of external intervention. It's not a crisis or a failed state that is the problem. The problem is continued intervention over years and years by forces internationally led by the United States, Canada, France, and others, continually peeping their heads into the country, rearing their heads, and not allowing the Haitian people to self-determine and elect their own government.
Are we looking at more increased presence by the UN, which in turn may lead to the U.S. also showing itself, especially when it comes to the politics of Haiti, which we know that they have some to have categorized as being interference in Haiti's affairs?
Well, it seems like there has been a lot of support for this multinational security force to enter Haiti. This is something that was pushed by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, although he pushed it as a non-UN security force, which is really peculiar for the UN Secretary General to do. But he was seeking, alongside the United States, support and troops and of course, financial support for this new, what people in Haiti say, is a new armed invasion, a militarized invasion of their country. And they have been able to get the support of several different governments, including within our region. Earlier this week, in Kingston, the capital of Jamaica, we're meeting Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State of the United States, and CARICOM, the leaders of the Caribbean community. And what a lot of the Caribbean community leaders have said is that they support this multinational security force in Haiti because they believe that the problem is what they call gangs. That's a term that has largely been rejected. The use is rejected by a lot of people who say that they are paramilitaries and that these are paramilitary groups that are armed from, of course, the United States, because Haiti is not a country which produces its own arms. And so it seems like there's a lot of support for that, and many countries have pledged a number of troops. So we do think we're going to be seeing some movement in that respect, but a timeline is unclear. Of course, as has been reported over several months, Kenya had pledged to lead this multi-security or multinational security force into Haiti, but that was stopped at a court level and hasn't proceeded, but it seems that the United States will find some other country to lead this invasion.
Thank you very much for that. From Bogota, Camila Escalante. We appreciate it, Camila. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says what is happening in the besieged Gaza Strip is an indication of Palestinians' steadfastness and resilience. He made the comments while meeting with a group of Quran reciters and memorizers in Tehran. Salman Kujuri has a report.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Thousands of Iranian legal experts and attorneys have joined the global movement of lawyers who have volunteered to file a genocide complaint against Israel, the International Criminal Court. Referred to as the Army of Lawyers for Palestine, the initiative has so far mobilized more than 200,000 lawyers worldwide. Kisumi Shahmadi has the details.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles Devers, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign. And an optimistic Gilles Devers, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way. And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. These lawyers believe that we live in a new era, in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Kisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocides in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murderer in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. Her suggestion that pesticides are in fact biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people, but the reality is Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientist for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
Four packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! You wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this.
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, "We're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer." In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named "Smoking and Health, The Need to Know" was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, "Is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong?" A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They published different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. but those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Thigaud, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another special edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition during the holy month of Ramadan, we will be having a look at different parts of the supplication Abu Hamza Sumali. We will be bringing you different commentaries on some parts of this dua. We'll be back after you listen to these parts.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ilahi law qarantani bil asfad ومنعتني سيبك من بين الأشهاد ودللت على فضائحي عيون العباد وأمرت بي إلى النار وحلت بيني وبين الأبرار ما قطعت رجائي منك وما صرفت تأميلي للعفو عنك ولا خرج حبك من قلبي أنا لا أنسى أياديك عندي وسترك علي في دار الدنيا.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this excerpt of the supplication of Abu Hamza Thumali. إلهي لو قرنتني بالأصفاد ومنعتني سيبك من بين الأشهاد. O Allah, if I had been yoked to and tied with chains, if I were cut off from the flowing stream of your bounties, وَدَلَلْتَ عَلَى فَضَائِحِ عُيُونَ الْعِبَادِ if the people were eyes to see how I was exposed to infamy and disgrace, وَأَمَرْتَ بِي إِلَى النَّارِ if I was ordered by you to proceed to hell, وَحُلْتَ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ الْأَبْرَارِ, and if you put a barrier between me and the pious people, مَا قَتَعْتُ رَجَائِي مِنْكَ, I would not cease to have hope. وَمَا صَرَفْتُ تَأْمِيلِي لِلْعَفْوِ عَنْكَ, it would not stop me from expecting your pardon and your mercy. وَلَا خَرَجَ حُبُّكَ مِنْ قَلْبِي, O Allah, this, even this, would not take away your love from my heart. أَنَا لَا أَنْسَى أَيَادِيَكَ عِنْدِي وَسِتْرَكَ عَلَيَّ فِي دَارِ الدُّنْيَا, I have not forgotten the bounties and the protection you made available for me in this world. Brothers and sisters, in the previous episode, we discussed the concept of fear and hope and how to practically strike a balance between them. And exactly this part of our discourse on the supplication of Abu Hamza was discussing. Imam alayhi salam says he has such high hopes on the Almighty Allah that even if he were to come to Allah with the disgrace, with committing sins, he still has hope that he would come to the Almighty Allah and Allah will have compassion for him. There are many similar passages in our supplications and litanies transmitted from the infallible imams. In Dua al-Kumail, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, يَا مَوْلَايْ فَكَيْفَ يَبْقَى فِي الْعَذَابَ هُوَ يَرْجُو مَا سَلَفَ مِنْ حِلْمِكَ, my protector, how should he remain in chastisement while he has hope of your previous clemency? أَمْ كَيْفَ تُؤْلِمُهُ النَّارُ وَهُوَ يَأْمُلُ فَضْلَكَ وَرَحْمَتَكَ, how can the fire cause him pain while he expects your bounty and mercy? So now it would be our responsibility to reflect a bit on ourselves and ask, can we really make such a supplication? Can we really talk to our Lord, our Creator, to the absolute cause of this world and the other like that? Can we have such sincerity with the Almighty Allah that even if people were all eyes and ears to see and hear our disgraces and infamies, we would be still pinning our hope on God? We would be hopeful of His previous clemency? Is it really true that on the Day of Judgment, if God exposes our sins before His creatures, before our brothers and sisters, if God enchains us and sends us to hell, we will still hope for His mercy? And more than this, can we still supplicate in such a way that our love for Him is not removed from our hearts and we still love Him? We all do need to reflect on ourselves. Ramadan, 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 Ramadan.
The ocean of dua.
So, being in such situation that Imam alayhi salam describes in this part of the supplication of Abu Hamza is really hard, and at the same time having our hopes on him, we cannot sincerely make such a claim. The way we behave, the way we think in this world bears testimony to this fact that we are not able to talk like Imam does. If we encounter a problem which is not easily solved, we naturally, in the first place, complain to God. Not only that love of Him has not remained in our hearts, but we also nurture an ill feeling toward Him, God forbid. We are so attracted, so attached to this world, that separation from it is sometimes unimaginable for us. So, our spiritual state does not correspond with that supplication. We cannot utter by ourselves this part of the supplication as with so many other parts of the other supplications. The point is that this supplication must be recited, must be read by the supplicant in order to nurture that kind of feeling and love in ourselves towards Allah.
Only the likes of Hazrat Amir al-Mu'mineen and Imam Sajjad alayhi salam can talk to God like that sincerely and make such a claim. But we utter these statements, we recite them as a way of quoting imams. Nevertheless, we must endeavor to create these states that bring and nurture that love of Almighty Allah in our hearts. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.